This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten.
I prefer to jazzercise my demons, but yeah.
And Keir Hansen.
Gallifrey Public Radio, now we have maths.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry, we'll warn you again. Welcome to episode 82 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we step up to the pitch, adjust our celery, and prepare to milk a queen bat.
Because that's easy.
Yeah, apparently. I am Jay, and with me in the GPR studios tonight is Keir. How are you doing, Keir?
Fantastic, sir. How about you?
I'm awesome. So today we are doing our fifth Doctor retrospective. And coincidentally, and you know, it's almost like we planned this kind of thing. I wish I could take credit for that. But today is actually Peter Davison's birthday, so... Spent the entire day watching some Fifth Doctor stories. I feel that's a good way to celebrate.
You know? Absolutely. Yep. No, I'll take credit for coming up with that idea. Yeah, hey, why don't we record on this day?
Yeah. But anyway, so we're talking a couple of Fifth Doctor stories today. And actually, we kind of span the entire gap there.
Yeah, I think we've got a pretty good jump across all of his tenure there, which is really good because... I mean, a lot of people who have not had an opportunity to dive into a lot of classic who have really missed out on not getting enough exposure to Davison because he really had some solid material. Even though a lot of long view who critics and evaluators will say that the show began its decline around this point. But they might be referring to it as far as overall, production budgets or viewership numbers or things of that sort, which doesn't necessarily take away from the quality of the scripts or some of the material that they tackled.
Oh, no. Some of these stories that we're talking about tonight were absolutely fantastic. I mean, I was amazed at the quality of the scripts and some of the acting.
Yep. But it's, you know, I guess they sort of look at it, a whole picture, or mm-hmm. they look at the overall span of a particular year, whether it be, you know, the 83 run where you had some episodes that were, you had some genuinely good material, but you had maybe some production issues or some budgetary issues where you had to step back and say, well, you know, if you could put that aside, you know, then you can appreciate them. But you had some great scripts that came out of them. You know, Modern Undead, Terminus came out of that same season. The Five Doctors, which was, you know, say what you will about it. You know, that wasn't really Tom Baker. No, well, no, fine. But, you know.
It was fun as anything, though. I love that one.
Yeah. And they were really kind of genuinely complex and enjoyable scripts, stories mm-hmm. in and of themselves, which is one of the reasons why, even aside from the broadcast productions, the novelizations for a lot of the stories that came out of these few seasons have done and continue to do exceptionally well. Because then you've got, obviously, the ability to build that whole backdrop in your mind as you're going through the story. Consider that a call to arms. Go out there and grab, you know, all the novels that you can. You can get the paperbacks for like $2 on Amazon and load up on a bunch of them and be able to appreciate these maybe better than, you know, if you're having a hard time getting access to some of the episodes from around season 19, 20, 21. You know, you can go and get the novelizations and enjoy them even better, perhaps.
Yeah. But, yeah, so, I mean, the first story that we picked today is, well, the first Fifth Doctor story, Castor Velva, which, I mean, this was a solid episode or solid story. You know, you kind of pointed out that the score's a little bit wonky and some of the special effects are lacking, but
Well, take the score in for what it is. I mean, at this point, we're really dealing with some issues of the era.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're getting to a point now where, similarly to, well, music production in general, people start realizing, oh, I've got these synthesizers. I don't even need to hire an orchestra anymore. Look at the money I can save, you know, and pour that money back into, you know, XYZ aspects of the budget. So when you start getting around to the fact that everything is being done on what, you know, to our ears at this point, sounds like a Casio keyboard and a 303 deck or something like that, yeah, okay, understandable. But if you can put that aside, mm-hmm. You know, if you can just appreciate the fact that they were doing what they did, which was, for the moment, perfectly acceptable because it was the same thing you were hearing off the radio dial. It was the same thing you were hearing in other television productions at the time. So it didn't stand out the way it does now.
Right. Yeah. I mean, now it's, you listen to it and you're like, wow, this is very, very 80s. You know, mm-hmm. it just has that feel to it. But yeah, it's, at the time, it wasn't as jarring thing. Now, the special effects, same kind of thing. You know, it's, for the time, they were probably, well, I mean, you can still see the Master's TARDIS hanging above the regular TARDIS is clearly a separate image.
But. Right. But then again, it's a matter of, I think there were moments where you'd have particular effects or particular things that they were testing on set that worked extremely well, certain costume decisions that worked extremely well. But I guess maybe what a lot of people were having issue with was the inconsistency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'd end up with a couple of sequences where things would work out really well because either when they were working in miniature or when they did a film overlay for a particular effect, and it worked exceptionally well.
Yeah,
you know, I'm thinking about one of the episodes that we dealt with tonight. There was a ship approach that was done. You know, usual starry space backdrop and a model ship on a wire sort of thing, but they got the angle of the camera approach just right. So that it looked like the ship was coming around to dock, and it was, you know, something. I actually thought to myself, "Wow, for 1983, they actually pulled that off pretty well."
Yeah.
You know, it was not a bad choice. And then 15 minutes later, you end up with something from the costume department that just leaves you shaking your head.
Yeah, well, you know, but I mean, for all intents and purposes, what we're looking at here is the stories, and for Castrovalva, at least, it was solid. This was a good story. I mean, you had the Doctor dealing with a really rough regeneration. I mean, he fell off of a radio tower and, you know, instead of going splat, manages to keep himself together long enough to actually regenerate.
Right. Yeah. Had to actually talk a couple of people through the understanding of the Watcher if they had not seen Logopolis to understand, you know, where that was leading into. And at the end of that whole little trilogy there. So this is a particularly rough regeneration and one that actually affects him for three stories before he actually kind of gets everything kind of locked down. But the interesting thing from a production standpoint was that this was the fourth story that Davison filmed as far as that production block. So he came into it ready to go. I mean, as far as his appearance, as a debut, mm-hmm. he had his character solidified. He had his particular delivery and his rapport with his companions solidified, and it just sold him really well.
Right.
It might not be a bad idea in the future to hand to anyone who's walking into this role, you know what? We're going to film two episodes first and burn them. And the third one is the one that gets put on the air, just so you've got these dry runs, because he was charming and entertaining from the jump as far as this was concerned.
Yeah, he really was. And I mean, you see, you know, a lot of times, I mean, we've talked about this, like, especially with 10th Planet, where, you know, the Doctor's just completely not there. They're like, oh, knock him unconscious, he's out for this episode, you know, and that was kind of routine. And here we see, you know, the Doctor is incapacitated, but he's still very much a part of the story. You know, you're constantly cutting back and forth between the companions and the Doctor.
Right. I definitely like the fact that in this particular instance, you've got the Doctor coming into not only an established companion. So again, for the viewing audience, you've got that bridge, something to carry them over from a comfort factor, you know, give yourself something that you can hold on to, your touchstone. But you've got a full boat.
Right.
I mean, this is the biggest the TARDIS crew ever gets.
Yeah.
So, and they all happen to be ones that are particularly endeared to the Doctor in his current regeneration because of the fact that he was the goofy uncle, so to speak, to Tegan, Nyssa, and Adric at the time, or you know, call whatever kind of a sort of a familial relationship that they had. But then Davison jumps into it, and class is in session.
Yeah, and I mean that's very much what it is from the get go. Is you know, when he's got his lucid moments, he's very much like, this is what we need to do. Here's the instructions. These are the reasons as far as I can explain them in the given time. And yeah, so we did get a lot of that very early on where, you know, you can see he's the teacher. He's the one that's going to get you through it. And he's going to, you know, walk you through. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it worked really well for this.
I also really enjoyed the fact that this is one of the few regenerations where even though he was kind of knocked off his keel, he had a lot of cognizance and recollection of previous iterations.
Mm-hmm.
So he was able to tap into some of that previous information and continued to do so through a lot of the stories to follow. He was actually, as far as some of the regeneration curves go, you know, we've talked about this a number of times, there's instances where certain regenerations just have no knowledge or very little working knowledge of some of their previous experiences. Right. You know, or it becomes very opportunistic. Oh, I've dealt with these before, or oh, you know, and he, you know, pulls some piece of recalled information out of thin air because it's something that's just readily at hand as far as his Gallifreyan experiences and the way that he processes his memories. And then there's other ones where he's completely at a loss and he's figuring it out, you know, as he goes.
Yeah.
Davison was given the opportunity to have a little bit more of that complete library. And made it really entertaining because it made everything analytical and strategical, and it worked really well with his compassionate element. And it's one of the themes or one of the aspects of him that just rings through entirely. There's not a single episode where he suddenly goes. Can you think of a single dark Davison episode?
Not really, no.
I mean, you can tell he gets angry at times. There's times when he loses his patience, mostly with Adric. But
yeah, but he doesn't really go dark at all.
No, but I think because of the fact that he is, you know, when you look at modern iterations of the Doctor's identity and his desire to be the diplomat, mm-hmm. and to reason things through, Davison was that absolutely personified.
Oh yeah,
and you see a lot of that. Right here, even though, you know, he's wavering in and out of lucidity here, he's still, you know, at the moments when he's got full, you know, compass mentis, you know, he issues out a couple of orders, tries to get the lay of things, warns everybody that he may phase back out again, yeah. and promptly passes out.
Yeah, so, I mean, but one of the things that you had touched on before that was absolutely fantastic through at least the first two episodes, mm-hmm. is we get to see the TARDIS playing a very crucial role in taking care of the Doctor.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, they're obviously, you get to see actually some interesting stuff around the interior too. This is where we first get introduced to the Zero Room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we get the whole idea of the fact, and it kind of makes some logical sense. You know, if he's going through this very rocky regeneration and he's physically and biologically unstable, and his mental faculties are directly connected to his physical health. If he can't calm his mind, then his body goes into that chaotic point as well. He needs essentially a sensory deprivation tank.
Right.
For all intents and purposes. So get him to the Z room or build him the Z cabinet.
Yeah, that was inventive.
Yeah. Well, I thought that was kind of cool, you know, and they're carrying around the styrofoam box. Oh. He's getting a little heavier. Oh,
he must not be concentrating enough to levitate inside of the box. Yeah.
but then, you know, he gets to the point where it's a matter for the costume change. Uh-huh. Obviously, you know, and the unraveling of the and the slow disassembly of Baker's costume.
That hurt. I mean, it made perfect sense, and it was a very good visual clue as to what was going on, but. As a Baker fan, that hurt.
Yeah, but note that it was the second iteration of Baker's costume. So we're taking apart the maroon scarf at this point, which was not quite as near and dear. You know, that was the beginning of the end there when they realized, oh, we're losing viewership. Change his costume up. Put him in a maroon thing. But But the whole idea of the fact, which played really well to Davison's particular interests as he is a cricketer,
right.
Was to provide him with that. You know, the TARDIS took care of her doctor, gave him the outfit, the mirror, you know, opens up the room and he sees in there and there's the cricket bats hanging everywhere and all the little pennants, and it's just his, you know, a little something to center him, to focus him so that he can have something of comfort.
Yeah.
Because she knows, you know, she knows him best.
Yeah, and then, you know, later we see him struggling around the TARDIS, and here comes a wheelchair just randomly rolling out. And, you know, it's just things like that where it's like, if you understand the character of the TARDIS and you understand the relationship, you can see so much how she is just doing everything she can to take care of him. And it was just a very touching moment, you know, and something that, you know, if you don't understand the show, you'd just be like, well, that was convenient, you know, and kind of laugh it off. But for people that actually understand it, it is such a touching moment. So, it really is great. And I love that, you know, that personification that we get there.
Yeah. But I would imagine that to a certain degree, that's actually one of those things that that takes increased strength in retrospect.
Yeah.
It may not have even been touched upon by the viewing audience at the time. In fact, there were a lot of interviews and things that you can get. Thankfully, a lot of the Davison material is available on DVD, so you can get a lot of the interviews with the production crew and cast. And a lot of them were discussing some of the backlash that they would get from the public on certain decisions that they would make through, you know, around 82, 83. And some of the subtle changes, obviously having a more youthful doctor, you know, a little bit more of an appealing actor to the female viewers and things of that sort, and you know, were they pandering to that? Then when you get around to Earth Shock, you know, and everything that happened there was a huge public backlash. And it came around to the fact that, and this was actually something that a few of the executive producers and scriptwriters at the time were saying, that it was a matter of being attacked by what we would say here in the U.S. as being these armchair quarterbacks, that were, you know, they're completely powerless to be able to actually do anything about it. So they would just complain about the decisions being made as if they could do better.
Yeah.
But it was a matter of, this was a very tumultuous time for the show. They really wanted to start to try and shake it up a little bit, because in the last couple of, well, I won't say the last couple of years, but call it the last series that Baker was in, the numbers were dropping.
Mm-hmm.
And they were feeling very stagnant with it. And he was almost kind of phoning it in for a lot of these episodes. And the public was realizing this. So they wanted to try and stir it up a little bit and cause a little bit of controversy.
Yeah, so I don't know. I think that this was a great introduction of the Fifth Doctor. You know, I mean, the storyline was really strong. And I mean, it really, really engaging. You know,
complex.
Yeah. And I mean, once you get through the initial, like, okay, they spend the entire first episode really in the TARDIS and dealing with, like, okay, we're flying. We don't know where we're flying. There's the, you know, handle the duck. And there's a lot going on, and you're just kind of like, okay, none of this makes any sense for the rest of the plot, and I understand that. So why are we going through it right now? But once you actually get into the main plot of the serial, it's actually a really, really compelling story. And it's at that point, you're like, okay, I want to know what's going on. Let's come on. Yeah. Give me more information quickly.
Yeah. It seems kind of unusual, you know, that they've brought the doctor here on the TARDIS's recommendation as a place of rest, because it's completely technologically undeveloped, and it would be someplace where he'd be able to essentially, you know, find a meditative state, you know, get himself away from all the things that are going to be a concern. And poor Treve seems to be, you know, very welcoming and
benevolent caretaker, kind of, yeah.
Yeah. So when it starts to unravel, you know, through about episode 3 or so, when you really start to see where all the concern, just put aside the fact that the warriors are wearing these bizarro
feathered
multicolored. I don't even, what the hell was that decision? All right, but thankfully, they didn't keep those things on for long, because that was just ridiculous. But, you know, after they get their, you know, stabbed pig or whatever it was that they were after. But when things really start to break down, you start to realize that, you know, who happens to be involved in all this? But, you know, well, spoilers for anybody who hasn't gone ahead and seen it, but we're hoping that you're going to track it down and see it. But we get one of these sort of confrontations with the Master that I think revived the concern that the production team had that Baker and the Master were squaring off so often that it was becoming very routine.
Yeah.
And this gave them an opportunity to really kind of shake that up quite a bit, because it was a different style of intellect going at one another.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was a little refreshing for me, you know, after watching a lot of Baker squaring off once again, once again, once again.
Yeah.
You know, and, oh, let me guess, we have to partner up to be able to get through this one? Sure. Okay, we'll do that again.
Yeah, so I mean, this was very interesting to see that the new dynamic. You know, you've got the young, energetic Peter Davison playing the Doctor, and then you've got Anthony Ainley playing the Doctor or playing the Master. You know, who's very much based his character off of Roger Delgado.
Yeah, sorry.
So yeah, it is an interesting dynamic between the two of them, and that you don't get it for very much of the episode. That was one of the things that I found interesting, was that, you know, they're only face to face for maybe 2 to 3 minutes of this episode, of this entire story.
Mm-hmm.
So it kept it limited. It didn't overdo it, because at this point you were used to seeing it, and you were like, okay, here we go again. You know, it's like I can tell within the first 5 minutes whether this is gonna, you know, how this is gonna play out. So it was interesting. You know, it was a new take on it, and it did help to keep it fresh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even some of the last final revealed elements that come about towards the end of the last episode are kind of interesting aspects. You know, it gives a lot of strength to Adric.
Yeah.
As a companion, because you realize that not only is the kid just this, you know, this little, you know, cocky super genius, but his mathematical and scientific capabilities, his technological know-how, are actually capable of not only creating or being very helpful in difficult situations, but it can be manipulated if falling into the wrong hands, as did in this case. And really pretty strong performances from Adric as well, even though he was caught in a wire web through 3/4 of the entire story. But he was kind of really entertaining. Mm-hmm. And we get the understanding of what the hell celery is all about, which is really beneficial in some of the other episodes that we, or some of the other stories that we latched onto for this retrospective.
Yeah. But you're right. Adric was very, very integral to the plot and a very good representation too. And I, the only ones I'd ever seen him in, I can't even remember all of them, but very, very few. And I always thought, okay, this kid's annoying. Like, I understand why they've got him, but geez, it's just irritating to where.
Yeah, he was the very bratty little know-it-all nerd. You know, if you see, even in Earthshock, where you're supposed to be really compassionate for him, he comes across as a bit of a know-it-all prick for a little while. But this is really kind of the Adric that sets that all up. And as long as you have that understanding, you think, all right, well, I can see why he was. Or if you actually track it back farther, take his introductions where he first comes in with Baker, you understand why it is that he's, you know, all right, enough about the badge. You know,
yes,
you're excellent at maths, for crying out loud. But here you go. Here's where it all, this is the culmination of why that's all important.
Right. And I mean, it was really interesting, and that's what I was thinking, is like, okay, if I went back and watched Earthshock now, I would have a completely different reaction to it, because a lot of it is based off of how you feel about Adric, and that episode or that storyline didn't really set him up very much as a compassionate character, whereas this one, you care about what happens to him, like, to the point where when you finally get him back, you're like, oh, thank God, they saved him, you know?
Yeah, very true. So just a note out there for those who are catching most of their Classic Who by trying to view through what's available on Netflix. Netflix does kind of throw you into the deep end for a number of these stories. So if there are certain aspects where you come into it and you know, understandably, you'll say, oh, God, this Perry character, I can't stomach. It's okay. It's okay. There are maybe a few out there that can actually win Perry over. And I will say this much, in defense of Nicola Bryant, go ahead and grab any of the her Big Finish work. She, these days, in some of the stuff that she continues to record with Colin Baker, so much more entertaining. And her American accent has gotten better. Go figure.
Yay!
She can say glass without saying gloss.
It couldn't have gotten much worse, so, you know.
Yeah, true. But this is, these are, it's stories like this which really help certain certain companions really kind of lock in. This might not have been Tegan and Nyssa's strongest story out there. Maybe a little better for Nyssa. Tegan really is kind of obnoxious as hell in this one. Just a bit. But you could tell she tends to be better when she's not wearing her stewardess outfit. Just note that. If you tune into a Classic Who episode and you see her there and she's not wearing the purple stewardess dress, you're probably going to be okay. If you flip into one and she's still wearing that thing, she's probably going to be nasal and annoying as hell. But just putting that out there.
Yeah. So the next story that we decided to tackle was Resurrection of the Daleks.
Yeah. I wanted to include this one, not necessarily because of the fact that it was the most well-done story in Davison's tenure, but it does use... it does give us a great standoff between some characters that we need to make sure face each other every once in a while. And that would be the Doctor in this fashion, our fifth Doctor, going up against Davros.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're coming across Davros, who's inexplicably, you know, in this prison ship with, you know, in cryo freeze or something. And
he calls that a failing of the human race. The fact that their idea of justice is to prolong the life of those who have been convicted. You know, he's 90 years, he was in some sort of cryo freeze or what have you, going slowly mad when they could have just executed him. Mm-hmm. But he considers it a weakness that they feel that this is going to be the justice. And it's interesting because, you know, we come to find later on, they do the whole same damn thing again. And they just, you know, he's not really dead. He's just been...
I mean, you're right though. This is a very interesting story. I mean, there's a lot going on and a lot of characters that you're not sure. Yeah. You know, the very first episode is really ambiguous. I mean, I went through the whole thing like, wait a minute, are these the good guys or how do they tie into
it's the, not just the first episode, the whole damn story. You've got a lot of people squaring off. There's a lot of laser battles going on back and forth between people wearing exactly the same uniform.
It's not even laser battles. It's flashlight battles.
There's not even lasers across the screen. You've got Daleks that then end up taking sides between those that are loyal to the Supreme Dalek and those that are loyal to Davros. It gets extremely confusing, but I think that's kind of one of the things that keeps it entertaining.
Yeah.
Is because everybody kind of jumps back and forth, and then you've got that poor schmuck in the middle who's Dalek-controlled, but he has these moments of clarity because the Doctor tried to pull him back, but it's not a permanent fix. So he's having all these battles within his mind, shooting at everybody who walks into the room, and ends up being the guy to pull the self-destruct pin at the end of it all. So really just, I mean, as far as, this is not one of those stories where you're thinking, all right, you can skip episode 2 or maybe just fast forward through episode 3 and pick it up at the end and understand what's going on. You have no idea.
You can watch all 4 episodes and still be kind of like, I think I got most of it.
Yeah.
But I mean, okay. So we see Davros again. This is the first instance of, you know, the Daleks using human agents or, you know, agents beyond their own species, which, right. I mean, that's kind of weird in and of itself, but I mean, it was kind of nice.
Which, by the way, we don't really see a whole lot of again until we start getting to the Dalek puppets.
Yeah.
In New Who.
Right. And that's the thing I was thinking of is I was like, okay, this is the basis that we used for Asylum of the Daleks. Yeah. This, mm-hmm. this is what helps it make sense. So it's interesting for that aspect. You know, we learned that the Daleks were defeated by use of a virus. So they're at a complete standoff with this race. They're at war with them. And
we come to find out that the Mavellans had tried to, had successfully defeated the Daleks, not eradicated, but at least defeated the Daleks through issuing I guess chemical warfare wasn't really illegal anymore.
Exactly.
You know, Geneva Convention doesn't really apply in deep space. So the Daleks are now in very limited numbers scattered across the universe, and they figure one of the best ways that they can then advance themselves beyond this virus, which is now documented and can be used against them at any point, is to go grab Davros out of stasis.
Right. So they, you know, they use their humans. They go and invade this prison ship. They take it over or attempt to. You've got a small resistance force that tries to fight them.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and then they get a hold of Davros. Well, you know, Davros got betrayed. He's not going to fall for that again. You know, mm-hmm. So he uses this little, you know, some kind of mind control or something to take people over and say, okay, you're going to be my pawn. You're going to be my pawn. Take them over so they can be my pawn. And he starts amassing this army to himself.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got the resistance fighters. You've got the Doctor and Turlo and Tegan all kind of trying to figure out what's going on. You've got the, you know, Supreme Daleks forces. You've got Davros's forces. And they're just all kind of button heads all over the place. It's right. It really confusing at times, but really interesting too. Really compelling.
Yeah, well, the one thing that stood out here is, okay, so you got a slightly different companion dynamic for those of you who are kind of familiar with the trio that the Fifth Doctor always traveled around with. Nyssa had already tapped out of this one,
mm-hmm.
So you're now down to you're down to Tegan and the Ginger, and it's funny, Turlo is completely useless.
Oh yeah,
through this entire story. In fact, he's just referred to as the boy. Everybody looks at him on camera as he's kind of wandering around there observing him. And basically, he's just there to be in the wrong place at the wrong time to get either captured or manipulated or just followed, lead him back to the doctor or what have you. But there were so many really complex elements that didn't get a whole lot of, I guess, unless you were really following it intently to catch the Dalek plan, and they love making plans, capital P plans all the time, was that they were actually planning on cloning the Doctor and using that clone to send back to Gallifrey to basically wipe out the High Council. So really, as far as some of the things, you think the Daleks are just these kind of these xenophobic killing machines that just go around wiping things out like a horde of locusts and just moving on to the next. They had a very specific target in mind here, and it would have made for a really, really interesting kind of a turn of events if they were able to carry some of these things out. Mm. You know, the whole idea of this cloning process was something we have not seen from them before. I thought that was I almost hoped that they had gone a little farther with that within this story, but
yeah, no, I mean, it was very interesting. The one thing that got me is I'm like, okay, they've got the Doctor in there and he's telling him, he's like, you know, you're really kind of useless when you can't kill anyone. And then the I can't remember his name, but the agent guy is like, oh, they can make you suffer, believe me. And the Doctor's like, but they need my brainwaves intact, so they can't do that yet. So I'm like, they have nothing on you. You're standing there. They can't do anything except physically block you from walking out the door. And yet he still lays down on the table to get cloned. I'm like, why?
Because it was a really, really comfy looking bubble wrap table.
You can't tell me
that table looked awesome.
I was like, well, okay, maybe they're like using the faraway angles, hoping that it looks different enough that people won't realize it's bubble. Oh, they're zooming in on his head on the bubble wrap pillow.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'd buy one. I'll make one.
Yeah. It doesn't take much.
Well, I mean, between that, and that's just the thing. They had a lot of really fascinating stuff going on in this episode, but there's a lot of times when this one kind of gets, or I should say the story gets pushed down every once in a while because of some of the production elements. But you really, yes, I understand. When the Daleks succumb to the Mavellan virus, they shoot shaving cream out of all of their open orifices. Fine.
Okay, that actually was effective for me because, yes, I mean, it's obviously shaving cream, but at that point, I'm bought into the story, and I'm like, oh my, okay, so they're getting subjected to this virus, and it's liquefying them to the point that it is spewing out of their casing. Like, that's intense.
Yeah. But, and then the costume decisions. You know,
yeah,
a lot of fascinating comments to make about the headgear.
The various damn headgear. Near everyone. All I'm saying is I want a Dalek helmet. That looks awesome.
You can't tell me they didn't look like Lord Helmet through this entire thing.
That's why it looked awesome.
I mean, really, I just kept expecting to see Rick Moranis come popping out of a Dalek casing somewhere. I can't breathe in this thing.
I mean, the eye stalk on the helmet, I'm like, really, what good does that do you? Like, it gives you a handle to grab onto and pull the helmet off with one hand.
And they did. And
all the time.
Wouldn't that be awesome if every hat you wore, if you wanted to take it off, you didn't have to like grab by the brim or whatever. You just had this giant handle in the front. You could just pull the thing.
Oh, but that was the great thing. I mean, the first time I saw it, I was like, I would so use that to pull my help. Oh, he just did it. That's great.
The game of baseball has changed entirely. Now all of your batter's helmets have handles in the front. Right. As soon as you make contact with the ball, yank that thing off and run, sucker, run.
Yeah. But, I mean, there was some interesting headgear in this story. Yeah.
But it does, it all comes down to another one of these, you know, great kind of showdowns. The combination of there has to be some military involvement, but there's a lot of intellectual battling between between the Doctor and dealing with the plans that Davros has set in motion, until he ends up getting betrayed by the own virus that he doesn't think is going to affect him. it's all around a genuinely entertaining story, and I think it's one of the reasons why I wanted to make sure that it was included, because even though a lot of people are going to say, oh, as far as complexity, as far as things that really get you kind of pondering, you know, Modern Undead, you know, and dealing with the Black Guardian and so forth, or some of the others that I kind of had on the shortlist, Earthshock for that matter, you know, because of all of the clout and the notoriety that comes around that one. Absolutely valid. Absolutely. But I wanted to put this one on there because this is one that a lot of people may not get an opportunity to see, that simply because damn near any story, when you're going to have Davros in there, it's going to get dense.
Yeah.
You know, because he's not just your typical kind of mustache twirling, you know, I'll get you at the end sort of a villain. He's definitely complex because he sees himself not only as this creator, he loves throwing that term around, but he also sees himself as superior to these perfect killing machines that he's created. Mm-hmm. So that in and of itself, when you've got the Doctor dealing with obviously the immediate Dalek threat, and then the fact that you now have two factions of them to deal with, which, I mean, almost as far as he is concerned, the threat is the same. I don't know. I found this one entertaining because of the fact that it was almost a battle on two fronts. But those fronts merge, and which is what we were talking about when we first started mentioning this, where it just becomes chaos at certain points, where there's, you know, humans in the same uniform. All of a sudden, you see when you see people dematerialize, you see that pink glow. You're like, oh, yeah. Crap, what's going to happen now? Oh, look, more Daleks. They're shooting at the Daleks that are already in the room. Oh, look, more Dalek agents. They're shooting at the Dalek agents who are across the room wearing the same uniforms that can't be distinguished from themselves.
Yeah.
And it just becomes madness.
Oh, yeah, it's just a giant cluster at this point.
Yeah, yep. But it's, I don't know, I found it genuinely entertaining. Even from the get-go, where it was like, you know, you had the 1984 in this, you know, factory district, and these, you know, British bobbies come chasing all these people out wearing this odd mishmash of all these different military uniforms, both modern and futuristic. Mm-hmm. And these bobbies come out wear, you know, sporting guns they should not have during this era.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and you can already tell, all right, something is horribly amiss through this. And that whole idea of that unstable ground continued throughout the story. I think it's one of the reasons what makes it so interesting is because it felt very disjointed through the entirety, all four episodes of the story. And I kind of enjoyed that. It was something that kept it from being, definitely kept it from being predictable.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I was kind of interested in, like, you know, when the colonel goes to leave the base or the factory, you know, he takes off his gun belt and he hands it to the Doctor. He's like, look, you're the only person that understands what's going on here. They need you to defend them. And and the Doctor's like holding it like it's, you know, like it's primed to go off
like
at
a dirty
any point.
Diaper.
Yeah.
He's the most nasty thing.
But then as soon as a Dalek comes through, or as soon as he picks it up and he looks like he's a pro, you know, mm-hmm. it was very interesting, the turnaround on that. And, you know, he's very quick to fire it at the Dalek. You know, when they find the one that's out of its casing, he's just, you know, right there with him, throw the blanket over it, and boom, just, you know, two to the head, you know, no problem at all.
No, it there were two of them standing there. They both unloaded the entire magazine into the thing. It's pretty brutal.
And then, you know, at the end, we've got him facing off with Davros, and he explains at one point, you know, that it's like, I had the choice to destroy them once before, and I'm not going to repeat that mistake. you know, I'm going to take him out. And you see him take one of the Dalek guns and go in there, and he's got it pointed at Davros's face, and he's like, I seriously hoped you would change because I didn't want to have to do this. And you can tell he's ready to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, it was a very, and a very dark, you know, I mean, we said earlier that it was, Davison is not a dark doctor. You don't get a lot of that, but this was kind of like, wow, he's serious right now.
Yeah, that's as close as it came. And again, it was one of the things that the Davros called him out on,
yeah,
was the fact that he wants to reason these things through, and he actually chides him for his compassion and his desire to see things through diplomatically, and he considers that a weakness. But you had brought up, obviously, as we're kind of nearing towards the final episode of this story, is the fact that after all of this carnage, and from a viewing audience, you're sitting there and you're looking at some of these final scenes, and there's bodies and Dalek casings, oh, yeah, blown open everywhere. And you're thinking, God,
the body count is, I mean, this is like bigger than Game of Thrones kind of thing.
Yeah, this is kind of brutal. And shouldn't this have some sort of an impact on the characters? And sure enough,
yeah,
Tegan raises her hand and says, that's it. I know I've said on numerous occasions, you know, please take me back to Heathrow. I'm done. But this is it. She's done.
Yeah. And I mean, she told the doctor, she's like, you know, it's not fun anymore. And that's what it boils down to, is it was just like it became too much for her. So she was like, no, I'm done. And, you know, the doctor goes to argue with her. And before he even gets a chance, she takes off and like she turns around and actually runs out of the room. Mm-hmm. I was like, she was dedicated to leaving. And it was like, wow, that. And it, at that point, it's like it all became, you're used to seeing the Daleks die, and you're used to seeing this kind of thing. And so it's like you go through this whole story, you're kind of like, okay, yeah, blow up, boom, hey, cool. You know, they did a cool special effect there and whatever. And then that happens, and you're like, wow, that's when it sunk in for me, was like the sheer number of bodies. And I was like, that was an absolute massacre. I mean, the only ones to actually survive were the Doctor and Turlough and Tegan, obviously. But it was kind of like, That was some serious stuff.
Yeah, very much so. So it was kind of a poignant exit,
mm-hmm,
for Janet Fielding on that. And I think it was a pretty strong way for a companion to bow out.
Yeah.
Granted, they did give her that quick little coda where she wants to run back just to let him know that, you know, that she remembers the encouragement bond they share and things, yeah. But he understood best that, you know, when she's gone, that's her decision. Let her go. She's safe.
Yeah.
You know, the situation is under control, so she's safe to run off at this point. But he's not going to hold her back, you know. And I think that's really indicative of Davison's doctor, that he respected his companions to that great degree. He may have gotten into intellectual arguments with Adric, might have scolded him for being childish. Well, yeah. Surprise at times.
Shock.
Well, maybe more so because of the fact that Adric at times was kind of socially inept, which is the case with these kind of, you know, prodigy children, where they are so far intellectually beyond their peers that they don't have that same proper social connection. So when the doctor has to try to explain to him how to be more compassionate or be more considerate of the emotions of the individuals around them, because they're not seeing things logically, they're seeing things emotionally, that's about as stern as he gets.
Right.
But through all this, you know, his concern and his protective nature of his companions is unparalleled.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was really interesting to see that. And I mean, this is towards the end of Davison's run as well. I mean, we see him out in like two more stories.
Right.
So, you know, everything was kind of changing at this point.
Yeah.
So,
but that carries over really well. You talk about protecting companions, and that's one of the cornerstones of the final episode the final story that we chose to include.
Yeah.
Which, again, I know we've talked about it before, and we've included it in some of our lists before, but that's just because it stands out.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Is Caves of Androzani. It's, you know, if Perry didn't have the mortal threat that carried throughout, as far as the toxicity that she was suffering through, and all of the concerns about, you know, Shara's Jek wanting, you know, my beautiful, which was just skeevy as hell.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he he throws himself into harm's way more times than not through this entire story.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you count up the number of times that the Doctor was in a life-threatening situation, it's more than the episodes included in the story.
Yeah, it seems to be, yeah. So let's dodge some explosions, get yourself into a firefight, leave a mud blast, you know, cling from a cave wall. What else can we do with you?
Yeah. And I mean, this was a very, very politically charged story. Like, I don't know what was going on at the time that the story was written, but it's like, it seems like somebody is trying to make a political statement with it.
Yeah. Well, you were March of 84 when this broadcast, which meant that this was back in production somewhere around late 83. I'm wondering if the Cold War backdrop or anything of that sort might have had anything to do with it. But it was a political theme or a military show of arms aspect. The gun runners versus the government entities that on the sly were actually, well, actually, you know what? Think about this. Go back, your Iran-Contra affair.
Okay.
And the idea of, granted, maybe this is proceeding a little bit, but this is the idea of government entities actually funding these freedom fighters. Or, you know, I'm making finger quotes here. But the whole idea, in this particular case, it was a matter of making sure that there was demand for a product.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it necessarily you want to tie that to the whole idea of the petroleum industry and things of that sort. But maybe because you've got this rare commodity in high demand that if you can make sure that it is not readily available, then it's... then your supply and demand curve remains in control. Mm-hmm. So while demanding it from one group, you're funding or facilitating the counterparties on the opposite side to make it difficult for them to produce it in abundance. I don't know. Maybe that has some kind of a tie-in to the oil industry or something possibly. Of that sort. Huh.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's just a very interesting story when you look at it in those terms. But
I found Jack particularly interesting as far as I don't even know if you want to call him. Well, I guess you could call him as a primary villain in this, mm-hmm. even though we come to find out that he's essentially, by the end of it all, he's a pawn like many of the others to a certain degree. And again, you get into that, you know, we have to partner up to get through this sort of a thing. But it's done for mutual concern over Perry. Mm-hmm. But I found him, again, you talk about the idea of the well-constructed villain. You know, you kind of understand he's been trapped underground, a genius intellect, developing his android technology that provides him all of the protection in the world, but provides him no companionship. So he's slowly going mad.
Right.
You know, we've seen instances of this numerous times through both Classic and New Who. But it always seems to work well. I don't particularly understand the whole idea of the black and white costume necessarily. It's just a decision they went with. And yes, the magma beast.
I loved it. I mean, come on. It looks like a bad Power Ranger villain. It really does.
Yeah.
But, I mean, apparently there was a whole second, like, not entire storyline, but there was a lot more to deal with the magma monster than just the little bit that we got. So it was just something that got cut, and they didn't remove the entirety of it or something. And I wanted to see the rest of that because supposedly it was a very interesting story. I can't remember where I found the details, but it was so long ago that I can't even remember them. But
right.
It was actually a really good story for it.
Well, but that was just it because of the fact that, you know, I think they still ended up with a very compelling story. Maybe if this were one, very few of Davison's stories ran over the 4-episode standard.
Yeah.
So maybe this could have been one of the ones where if they had given it the 5th or 6th, I know at this point they were drawing the conclusion. This is his swan song. So, you know, they structurally wanted to just propel the thing along so they could get into Baker's introduction and so forth. But just the same, you know, this could have been one where they could have put additional material in. There weren't really many slow points in this where you thought, oh God, are they just going to, you know, why do they even include this sequence? You know, is this character really necessary? The only thing I think of is it took an awful long time to milk Queen Bat.
Yeah,
that's all. The only thing that stood out in my mind is, like, dear God, how long is he going to be walking across this ledge?
Well, I mean, have you ever tried to milk a queen bat? It's a tedious process.
It's on my bucket list.
It's going to happen one day.
Yeah, fall off a radio tower, milk a queen bat, a couple other things. You know, they're all on.
You might want to look into the order of those things. I'm just saying.
Yeah, but then one of the last things that I really took away from this, which I thought was really kind of interesting, was the whole idea of Robert Holmes as the writer, his take on the regeneration process.
Mm-hmm.
He saw it as this idea of literally seeing your life flash before your eyes. So he was, you know, visited by, you know, all of his, you know, previous companions and things, the master jumping in. So his companions telling him, this is not your time yet. It's not time to die. You need to regenerate. You need to come back. Master crosses into his mind. Die, 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 die. You know, I mean, just really kind of an interesting overall idea of pulling it all, similarly to Davison's entire tenure, the fact that he had cognizance and would tap into these previous experiences and previous partnerships and companionships and things, and he would leverage that. His bowing out needed to include all those things. So, and I think that, you know, even though we're shining a very bright light on Fifth in this instance, you got to admit, Colin's introduction at the end of this hall. Popping up and just basically verbally bitch slap and parry for two lines before going to credits was a nice intro.
Oh, yeah,
I thought that was pretty solid.
Yeah, especially when you've got, you know, Davison's whole regeneration being upstaged by Nicola Bryant's cleavage.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah.
Yeah, you can't even deny that that's what was going on.
Well, at the same time, she was the same one doing all the photo shoots and the bikinis and whatnot. So, yes, for all of you out there who have not seen them, go ahead and do a standard image search on Nicola Bryant circa 1983. And she was doing bikini shoots because she was the most willing to say, yeah, okay, I might be a companion, but at the same time, haha, I'm a sex object and I'm going to make some cash off of this.
Yeah.
So, you know, but she runs funny. I'm going to say that much. When they put her on the surface of the minor planet and they had her running across to follow the tracks, man, that woman runs funny. I can't figure out what it is she's doing, but it's like her hips bend the wrong way or something because she looks like she's about to have a spasm. I'm just putting that out there. Just to take distraction away from the cleavage. So. But solid writing from Robert Holmes, who ends up going on to write tons of material. And obviously Graham Harper, as your director, this was his directorial debut. And just did, and you could tell he preferred working, on film more often than the on location. So, a lot of things ending up going on, with Colin Baker to continue. He liked doing all the outdoor and on location shoots because it meant he ended up actually getting able to shoot an 8mm and things, be able to get things on film rather than on video capture, which was becoming more and more the trend. But so you ended up just with a more cinematic quality to a lot of the episodes, especially when he was at the helm. So good thing to appreciate in this one too.
And I mean, you could see that in this one is there were a lot of advanced techniques being used in shooting it, and it was. You know, not only the director, but a lot of the people in the production of the show were wanting to advance it. I mean, this was a show that had been, you know, they had a formula, they went with it, and every now and again something would happen to shake it up. But, you know, in this one, you really see, okay, let's try some of these new techniques that they're doing. Let's try and, you know, work this in and really make this compelling visually as well as intellectually. Yeah. And they did a brilliant job with it.
Yeah, this is a genuinely enjoyable story, start to finish. It definitely, and it does not let up at any point. It's from the point of the at each cliffhanger break between the episodes, whether it's the firing squad or what have you. It's all definitely, you know, one where you're ready to jump to the next episode.
Yeah,
you know, so And thankfully, this is the Netflix available episode, one of the couple of Davison Netflix available episodes. Another one on there, by the way, just in case you get the opportunity, and it's definitely worth your time to watch because it was on my short list, was Visitation. Mm-hmm. Make sure you get a chance to spin through that one. It's also the one where he decides to actually break a sonic screwdriver, so nice little piece of canon there, so enjoy that. So it's just it's a great one to be able to get a hold of, and it's one of the reasons why on all of the compendium lists out there, it almost always tops the classic Who story rosters, because it's got so much going on for it in terms of understandable political struggle, military involvement, intellectual battling with both the immediate threat on location in the form of Jack, but also what's going on off planet. So then that aspect of it, of a presidential assassination and all kinds of kind of seemingly disjointed, but the interconnectedness of it all is what makes it a really rich story.
Yeah. And incidentally, Peter Davison has said since this story came out that had the majority of his stories been written and shot like Caves Van Der Zanne, he would have stayed on for a lot longer.
Mm, nope, I can absolutely buy that. Plus, it also gives us perfect justification for the celery. The celery is well justified in the whole thing about the fact that the human, or at least the Earthling olfactory system, is not capable of fully appreciating the restorative effects of the smell of celery. So for those of you who are planning on pinning it to your lapel, or some of you who already have, congratulations, you're protected from more than you know.
Yeah. And that was directly because Peter Davison had gotten to the point, he was like, look, I need an excuse for him to have been wearing the celery the whole time. Because originally it was just a costume choice, just kind of like, oh, there, yep, celery on the lapel. And he was like, no, I need a reason for it to be there. And so finally, at the end of his run, they're like, okay, fine, here's an excuse.
And it works.
Yes.
And it totally works.
I like it.
Yep. And we know some of our cosplayers are going to have an interesting time trying to figure out how to keep that fresh.
Yeah.
Make it out of yarn.
There you go. Well. So next week we're going to be looking into Colin Baker. And this is going to be interesting because, if you look at the entire run of the series, there's no doctor that people love to hate on more than Colin Baker. Like, he is he's the whipping boy of the doctors, really. Yeah.
Go ahead. You know what? Because I get it now. I think I totally understand everything about the choices that he made, and I'm in it. I actually have a harder time now, in retrospect, getting through Sylvester McCoy than I do Colin. And that's not to say that, to take anything away from Seventh Doctor. I appreciate that fully well as well. But in terms of the vitriol and the attacks that Colin suffers or has suffered, no, you know what? I understand now. Mm-hmm. Because you really have to take in more than just a couple of them to see the fact that he is so consistent with his bravado. And we'll get into this next week, but it's just one of those things where, he made a choice, and I don't even know necessarily that it was entirely his choice. They wrote him to a great degree to be the way he was, because they were, again, it's a matter of, when they went from Tom Baker into Davidson, they had to start, spinning it a little different way to shake up the viewing audience, to give them something that they weren't prepared for. You talk about something not to be prepared for. Throw this guy at you wearing that.
Oh, jeez.
The only way that you could shake it up anymore would be to cast him as female.
Yeah.
That's one of the few other things you could have done, because he came into it, we don't know really what to expect right now from Capaldi, other than the fact that he potentially could be a little gruff, but we're not expecting him to come out and be an egomaniacal prick. But that's what Baker did.
Yeah.
And he didn't back down for years.
Yeah, I mean, from the get-go, that's exactly how he was.
He just came to accept it. And I give him credit for his commitment to it. But we'll definitely get into that next
week. Oh, yeah. I mean, we're taking that as a personal challenge for next week. We're planning on defending him to the nines.
Yeah.
So absolutely. You know, if you have something that you just cannot get past about Colin Baker, let us know so that we can take that into consideration and, you know, and talk about that as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, mm-hmm. if you're one of the few people who calls the Sixth Doctor your doctor, I've yet to meet you, but
please contact us.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Because I want to know what it is that people enjoy about him most. I mean, I've got my things that draw me to him, but it's like, I want to know what it is that people, you know, really latch onto with him.
I've got one person I want to contact. I'll see if I can track him down. I spoke to him last year at Kineticon. He was a representative of the Bostonian Whovian cosplay group, which is big. It's probably about 200 to 300 strong that came down to Hartford last year. And he is, I mean, he cosplays Colin. He's got the horrible patchwork outfit and everything. And he was giving a bit of an explanation in a panel that he was sitting on last year about why it was that he was so attuned to Colin's particular persona. And I think, if I remember correctly, a lot of it really had to do with the fact that he was unabashed about it. He was who he was. You could accept it or not. But it was his particular interpretation of the Doctor. The Doctor is who he is and doesn't make any concessions for anyone. So if you were to really boil that down to its essence, you could be as outlandish as you wanted, but as long as you didn't apologize for it and you got the job done, you're still the Doctor.
Yeah.
And I think that was one of the things that he admired. So I'm going to see if I can touch base with him and see if he can give us a little bit of an insight on that one.
Yeah, that'd be great. So yeah, send us all your feedback on that one. Let us know, you know, love or hate. We want to know what your opinion is on Colin Baker, because this one is definitely one that, you know, people have some opinions about.
Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm.
But
you talk about modeling. I'm going to plant this bug in your ear just as something to think about for next week. Think about when Baker was at his most, belligerent. Was that really any different than some of the reactions you had gotten decades prior from William Hartnell?
Hmm.
So go ahead and stick that in your potted plant there. Let it grow for a week. I don't know where I'm going with that analogy. That was horrible. The
sentence got away from you, didn't it?
Yeah, I fell apart at the end of it all. I started out really strong.
All right. Well, we've got a little bit of news this week. So the first one being that the Ben Miller is joining the cast for Series 8. So, I mean, we're getting a lot of this information coming out about who's going to be joining and who they're casting for various things. And it's really kind of exciting seeing the picture that's getting painted here.
Yeah, and Miller himself is an admitted Whovian in his own right. In fact, he was really concerned about this because when he got the nod for it, he was concerned that when he wasn't actually filming his scenes, they were going to make him leave the set because he just wanted to sit there and watch everything. So his only worry was that they're going to make him leave the set when he's not actually on camera. So, which is exactly, wouldn't we all do the same thing? You know, even if you were a walk-on role, wouldn't you just ask, can I just stay here? I'll be quiet. I'll be over by the, you know.
Do you want me to carry something for you? I mean, I can do some extra stuff just to, you know.
Yeah. I'll replace your fruit cup from the craft table when it runs. That's fine. Just let me stay. So, yeah. And as far as the role representation, what do we know for Mr. Miller as far as he's going to be
Nothing set in stone yet. There's a lot of rumor going around, but all we know is that he's going to be in the third episode written by Mark Gatiss, which is the one that's supposedly about Robin Hood.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, again, nothing is confirmed at this point, so it's all just, you know, conjecture.
Right. So we're not necessarily dealing with another villain casting or anything of that sort, so we haven't gotten any more news as far as... solid script elements.
Right.
This week, anyway.
Yep. So, but the next thing that we've got is that the city of Boscombe has an official police box to now.
Yeah, they were talking about this. There were some news reports about they knew it was coming.
Yeah.
And they had been saying that they were, because they're now starting to drop some functional and some non-functional police call boxes around the area. There's still a number of them in Scotland and Wales that are still, they're actually still practical. They actually still do. You can pick up the line and actually talk to the police.
Imagine that.
Yeah, go figure. But then there's other ones where which are out there and they're strictly for show. And you actually, in many instances, especially around London proper, the two or three that are still within the metro area, you actually have to pay to approach them. It's like Stonehenge now. But this one is more for entertainment purposes.
Yeah, right. So it's just kind of interesting seeing that, you know, they're putting it out there and just the different things that are going on. That they actually had a Dalek out there for the unveiling. I think it was a fan-made Dalek, so I don't think it was anything official from the BBC, but just kind of interesting seeing how people are approaching these kind of things. But, you know, this police call box, the doors actually pull to open, you know, like they're supposed to. Just an interesting little tidbit.
Well, you know, no accounting for canon.
Yeah, so... but then the last little bit of news we've got, user Andrew Clark 2 on the Lego Kuso actually got enough support for his Lego TARDIS to reach review status. So now it is up there for Lego to look at and say whether or not they actually want to produce this.
Yep. And these are going to start now with all the attention of the first one that got greenlighted a couple weeks ago. Now people, because you can go through the Kuso index there and be able to see all the ones with related projects and so forth. And people are seeing that there were, oh, okay, there was this other, you know, Whovian project that had made it, because you have to get 10,000 of public approvals in order for it to be put forward into any official review. Some of these ones that were wavering around a couple thousand evaluations and such are now getting cast with new eyes, because all these people that came in to see what the big news was about the first one to hit 10K, now we're seeing all the ancillary projects that are just as impressive in their own right. Some of them that don't even require customization of sets. Mm-hmm. They just need to be bundled properly. They're using components that were already available from some of the other Lego collections that are out there, which I think is a little more interesting. If you don't have to actually utilize sticker sets and things of that sort, or precast custom pieces, mm-hmm. and you can actually accomplish these using pieces that are already out in production and publicly available, then I would think that makes it even easier to move forward from an evaluation standpoint, is to say, okay, well, you know, we've already got these things die cut. We just need to, you know, repackage them and figure out a selling price.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that, and it's really cool. I mean, that's always been my biggest complaint about Lego, is I'm like, okay, why do I need to buy the licensed stuff? Isn't that the point of Lego, is just to get these bricks and build it?
Yeah, I want the random buckets.
Exactly. God, I miss those. But that is kind of cool. And, you know, as much as I complain about it, like, I'm probably still going to wind up with the Lego set that has the TARDIS stickers on there and has a, you know, custom-built 10th Doctor figure in it. Yeah. I'm still going to do that, but it's... Yeah, I mean, it's just kind of cool to see this stuff going forward, because, I mean, come on, Lego is part of everybody's childhood, and seeing it kind of get this is just very exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. So get a chance. Go ahead and through. You can find Kuso, so C-U-S-O-O
spelling. The links are in the show notes.
The link is going to be in the show notes. Just assume it from there. And you'll be able to link this particular project, but go ahead and give your approval to other ones that you think are equally interesting, because this is the way that these things move forward. Mm-hmm. And I would think that to a certain point, once they get to a saturation point where there's half a dozen of these, all of a related theme, you know, in this case having to be the Doctor Who franchise, they can then say, okay, it's really not just a matter of having a couple of little collections here and there. Now we can come out with an entire set,
yeah.
You know, same as they've done with some of these other, you know, film-related or pop culture-related projects. And move that forward. It becomes a more marketable, as if they need any sort of an acknowledgement that this is actually marketable. But, you know, so be it. They're a business, and they want to make sure they're going to get their ROI on this. Right. So, yeah, but go ahead and thumb through, because you'll also, you know, you get down that rabbit hole. I went through there once to try and find, you know, I was looking over some of the ones that were getting the public attention, and I remember coming across the Doc Brown flying train. I came across all this other really cool related Battlestar Galactica stuff, and it was just this, the things that people were coming up with were just phenomenal. And you know, and working with brick sets that were already out there, but they thought of it.
Yeah,
you know, you wanted to do it. You couldn't figure out how to do it. You didn't know how to build a Firefly. They did. So give them the thumbs up approval, and who knows? You know, maybe 2 years from now, you'll see it on the shelf, and you can get it for your kids or yourself for Christmas.
Yeah. See, at least I've got the excuse. You know, it's like, oh, here, I bought you this. Here, let me help you build it. No. I'll just go ahead. I don't understand
what this ship is. No, it's okay. It's a Firefly unit. It's not important. We'll explain that later. You're not old enough to watch a show, but just give me the toys. Give me the toys.
Yeah. No. That would never happen in this house. Of course not. No. But that's about all the news we've got this week. So we have, at this point, as we record this, less than 2 weeks until Geekation.
Yes. There is, I actually checked, there is still an opportunity to get damn fine rates out to Las Vegas, and there will still be some of the block seats or block rooms available at the plaza for those of you who care to join us for that weekend. So it'll be through the 25th through the 27th of this April. We'll be staying at the plaza in the Fremont district. It's going to be a pretty damn good time. We've got some things on the agenda, including some meals out, a couple of shows, a couple of concerts, a cosplay walk of the Vegas Strip on Saturday night, which is going to be fascinating because we will probably end up making money that night from people asking for photo ops. So, because that's just what happens on the Strip. If you're out there in the most outlandish costume, someone will hand you a camera and $2 and say, would you mind? So,
yeah,
there you go. So, yeah, geekation2014.com. So that's geekation2014.com. Get the details about where it's being held, when it's being held, how to get in touch for registration to let us know when you're coming into the area. And we'll even try and help as best we can with some of the logistics of getting you to and from the airport and things of that sort, too. So big community outreach on this one. We'd love to have you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And we're going to be recording live from Geekation. So if you want to come and actually be a part of the studio audience for one of our podcasts, we would love to see you guys there and get your feedback live as we record. So
come on down. Bitty bitty.
Yeah. All right. Well, this has been episode 82 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, yes, well, that's democracy for you.
And this is Kier saying, earthlings.
We'll see you next week.
Amazing.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows by calling 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1477 to leave us a voicemail. You can head to GallifreyPublicRadio.com to leave comments on each episode. There you can also keep up to date on all the latest news and gossip, as well as what's going on in the community. Also make sure to head over to GunnaGeek.com to find out lots of other high-quality, geek-centric shows. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2014.